everybody. Amanda Van Hyl here, and welcome to episode 33 of the Shine Sparkers podcast. I'm joined today by Roy, Irene, and special guest Laura Kate Dale. And she is a successful journalist, accessibility advocate, author, and just overall great person. So, Laura, why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
Hi, thank you for having me. My name's Laura. I have been a full-time video game critic of some kind or another for about a decade now. I got my start doing freelance work for sites such as Polygon, IGN, Kotaku, etc. Over the years, I've done editorial positions at places like Destructoid. And for the last 5 years or so, I've largely been talking about accessibility in video games. So ways that we can make more video games playable for a wider range of disabled players. Beyond that, I've been a big fan of Nintendo games for a very long time. Back when the original Switch was coming out, some people will remember I was one of the people leaking information about the Switch back in the day, most of 10 years ago now. But yeah, that's me. Hello.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I'm really excited to have you here.
I'm very excited to be here.
All right, so first thing we're going to be talking about is accessibility in the upcoming Metroid game. And that has just been a topic that has been ongoing as far as gaming is making games more accessible to people with various disabilities. And we've seen it all sorts of different ways. We've seen like changes in lighting. We've seen like arachnophobia mode in some games. So just giving more people a chance to play. Controls are a big thing because not everybody can hold a traditional controller. And so that's another thing that has to do with accessibility in gaming. And so we're just going to talk about like what kind of settings we'd like to see that would improve future Metroid games and make them more accessible for others. I know for me, I mean, I don't have like, the only issue I really have is like my hands shake, so I have a hard time with motion controls. So not having to use motion controls to me is always a great thing. but I know like a lot of people, there's a lot of like flashy lights and things like that. And I know that can trigger seizures in some people. And so any kind of way to like turn the lighting extremities down, I think would be a really good benefit.
There's a whole bunch of different ways that you could go with accessibility in the series. Starting by looking at like the Prime game specifically, being in first person, one of the things I struggle with sometimes with first person games is I struggle with chronic motion sickness.
I was going to say I have that problem myself.
Yeah, which tends to be worse in first person games. Yep. And like, there are definitely some things you can do to help with that. Some common things that are seen is things like having a persistent dot in the center of the screen to give you something to focus on your screen center. Making sure to minimize things like camera shake or the amount that your head bobs up and down as your character's walking around. Settings around things like Nintendo really is resistant to this, but in other modern first-person games, giving you the option to turn off things like motion blur, chromatic aberration, to tweak the visual clarity of the game can help a lot. Field of view is a really big one. Widening the amount of left to right space that you can see on screen at any one time. That's one that's like, I suspect Nintendo will always be really hesitant to do that with the Metroid series, just because you are inside the headset of Samus. It is such a one-to-one, this is meant to be the field of view a person has. I feel like Nintendo they're the kind of company that would really get hung up on, no, a person can't have a wider field of view than a person's meant to have. I don't know if you agree with
that
me on that.
No, I absolutely get that, because Nintendo, they're very big on games as an art form. And so they'll have like this vision of this is how this game is supposed to be. No, we're not going to adjust this because that conflicts with our vision. I realize that, you know, it might help other people, but that's not our vision. We want this. Yeah. This is our artistic vision.
Yeah. Accessibility wise, this last console generation been weirdly hung up on what's the in-universe justification for us to let you have things be more accessible? The one I think of from early in the Switch generation was Pokemon Sword and Shield. If you wanted audio sliders to, like, change the balance of audio, you had to go find an NPC in a town who was, like, completely not signposted, who would give you a pair of special in-game earbuds you could put in that unlocked audio sliders. Because
I don't think I ever got to that part in it. I didn't even know that was a thing, and no. I played Pokemon Sword and Shield.
And I guess that the logic was, in the real world, you can't change your audio balance, but if you have headphones, you can. But, like, it's the kind of thing that makes me suspect Nintendo would not ever start playing around with giving you wider field of view. Which is a shame, because they're, like, finally using powerful enough hardware that they could probably afford to do that and not have a big impact on performance.
And it's funny that you mention, like, you know, Nintendo saying, like, no, we have to have a real world reasoning behind this and how, like, no, it has to be this way for a reason. Right now, you know, Epic Universe is currently in previews, and they've got the Donkey Kong minecart ride, but they also have a Donkey Kong, like, Sunday, and right now they will not allow anybody to, like, modify it for allergy reasons, because, like, no, our vision is that it has to look just like this. And so we will not serve it without, like, the little popcorn pieces on the top. We will not serve it without these things in it. And it's like, but it's just a topping you don't have to put on top. No, we're not allowed to serve it that way. And it's the same with, like, their food at the Toadstool Cafe. Like, no, you can't modify the hamburger to have just meat and cheese on it. Like, it has to be this way because this is how we intended it to look.
I wish I could say I was surprised to hear that, but, like, that honestly does feel like how Nintendo has treated accessibility.
It really does.
It's
like, no, it's not supposed to. If it looks different, then that'll have some kind of impact on how people think of us. It's like, dude, it's a Sunday.
Yeah, Nintendo can be stubborn with this stuff. Like, again, right at the start of the Switch generation, Pokemon Let's Go Pikachu and Eevee. To catch Pokemon when docked, you had to do motion controls to throw your Pokeball.
Right.
In handheld mode, there was an alternative option where you could just use an analog stick and a button. Could they offer you that option while docked if you have disabilities that stop you doing the throw motion? No, because that's only for handheld mode, so why would we offer it to you docked? We've decided that's a handheld-only feature, therefore it's a handheld-only feature.
And it's like, even for non-disability reasons, maybe you just don't want to throw stuff in the house, or you just don't want people seeing you just try and throw it like that.
This is why the Wii remote needed to add wrist straps, is because people would throw their Wii remotes and hit people in the head with it.
Yep.
But yeah, talking a bit more broadly about, like, as someone that's very enthusiastic about, like, ways that the Metroid series and Metroidvanias more broadly can be more accessible, one of my favorite things that I've seen in the genre in recent years was Prince of Persia: The Lost Crown, back at the start of 2024, had an option for, at any time, you could take a screenshot of the game and pin it in place on the map for where on the map you took that screenshot. Wonderful feature if you're someone, I've got a condition called aphantasia, which means that I struggle with visual imagination and memory.
Okay, I've heard of that.
Yeah, my brain just does not do visual recall and imagination properly.
Right.
I really struggle with, in Metroidvania maps, remembering where a thing was I meant to come back to later. And, like, Metroid Dread did a great job, I will give it credit, for having a very robust system of different kinds of symbols that mean different kinds of locked doors, so that when you get a new power up, like, oh, I can see at a glance what kind of doors I can go through now that I couldn't before. But this screenshots pinned physically to your map tool really is, like, the next step forward, I think, in the genre for, like, I can remember exactly why that's a room I have to come back to.
I want that in every game. I have zero sense of direction, so if I could, like, have visual markers that I could pin on there, I want that. That would be amazing.
Yeah, it's such a simple thing once you mention it, and it's like, I just want it in every Metroidvania now. I think that the implementation they have in Prince of Persia: The Lost Crown is pretty good. And it's one of those, like, if, as we were saying, like, Nintendo likes to have an in-universe justification for accessibility things, this feels like such a one that you could easily do for the Metroid series, because Samus's headset is clearly already a scanner, it's inputting visual data. It's so much not a stretch to have her click a thing on her visor, take a photo, and pin it to her map. That's, like, really within the rule set that we could imagine.
I mean, if anything, they could turn that into, like, another quest or collection thing, is, like, take a picture of various locations. I mean, they do that with Zelda in Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom with the compendium. It's, like, take a picture of every single animal and every single little, like, weapon and all of that. And then you can use that to, like, douse to get to whatever location so you can find them. So it seems like something that they would easily want to do.
I think the high technology behind Samus's helmet by itself lends itself to having various effects which they can employ, like having a high contrast visor mode, for example. Maybe have the helmet mute certain sounds if there's certain sounds you don't like.
I was going to say, I think that, like, the fact that you're experiencing the world through this filtered lens of Samus's helmet, I think you're totally right. I think if you want to justify it in universe, things like turning off tinnitus sounds, reducing the dynamic range of volume so that, like, the quietest sounds are a little louder and the loudest sounds are a little quieter, so that you've got less range between the volumes. As you say, high contrast mode. I think even further than that, you can start leaning towards, like, offering a degree of aim assist. You know, if you want to contextualize these things in universe as the whatever suit it is that Samus is wearing in this game, you can switch on an additional, like, let the suit help with my aiming a little bit. Again, I think there's no real reason that shouldn't be a thing that would fit. You know, you should be able to offer accessibility whether it fits in theming yeah. or not. But
yeah, I mean, they have it even in Mario Kart where there's, like, the type of, like, steering assist so you don't constantly fall off the edge. I mean, they're essentially, like, bumpers on a bowling alley.
Yeah. And part of me does wonder, like, is the reason that they offer that in Mario Kart but not in something like Metroid? Because they're like, Mario Kart is families will play this. This is Metroid. That's for adult serious gamers. Therefore, like, we don't need those same everyone can play accommodations. Sometimes feels like it's the attitude.
That's probably it.
That could be it. Because, like, there was a game that came out a year or two ago. It was the Disney Illusion Island, I believe, is what it was called, yes. Or Island of Illusion. I call it Baby's First Metroidvania because that's essentially what it is. But you can actually change the difficulty because, I mean, it is for, like, little ones to experience, yeah. like, a Metroidvania for the first time. And the writing is brilliant. But you could actually turn it to where, like, you can take all the damage in the world and nothing happen. And for someone just learning how to play, like, a little 4-year-old, that's brilliant. But then there's also, like, people that either just want to experience the story or just have a hard time with it, that maybe they just want to get through it, and that's okay. Like, yeah. I don't really have a problem with, like, difficulty modes like that, because, I mean, we all know that, okay, if you play something on hard, then yes, you've done, like, a way harder thing than playing it on, like, ultra easy. That's fine. It doesn't make the person's, like, hard playthrough any less valid.
Agreed. One of the accessibility things that, like, I would love to see offered, and I know that this is one of the ones where when I suggest it, there's going to be some Metroidvania people who will push back a little at the suggestion. I think there is value in offering, let's say you have gotten really lost, really stuck in Prime 4, and you're just like, I don't know what... Somewhere I've missed a door that I have the tools to open that will take me to the next tool that'll open things up, and I just cannot work out where it is I've missed a single door somewhere. Offer the ability to have a line that shows you where the thing that is holding you from progression is. Because, like, I know some people will say, oh, well, that takes away the whole point of a Metroidvania, but it's like...
Then don't use it if you don't want to.
Don't use it if you don't want to. And, like, hey, maybe someone is there because they enjoy the shooting and the story and the world building and the combat, and not so much the you know, non-linear exploration. Maybe they love the non-linear exploration, they're just having a mental block moment and they're going to hate the game if they can't work out how to progress. Like, a fallback solution where it's just like, look, just give me the line that shows me where to go. There are so many people that get so frustrated with games in this genre who I think just the ability to occasionally do that would really keep them on board with enjoying it.
Absolutely. I remember when I first started playing like Metroid games, and the very first time I played, I got so frustrated because like, I don't understand. What do you mean? Because I had never played a Metroidvania before. I was like in high school at the time, and I was very confused. It's like, wait, I go back and forth. Okay. And something like that would have been great, because then I wouldn't have gotten so frustrated, because then later on, you know, I'm playing it and people are like, no, that's part of the process, is getting frustrated. I'm like, okay, I feel better about that. But at the same time, had I known that as a kid playing that,
sure,
would have helped. And then, you know, if you start like when you're first playing and you get those little lines to tell you how to get to something, then like eventually you'll get to a point where you don't need that in future games.
Right.
Or again, even if it's not like a direct line leading you somewhere, I'm going to keep bringing this up because I just think this game was a really good example of things being done well. That Prince of Persia the Lost Crown had an option where you could turn on, it doesn't show you the route to get to where you're going, but it would just put a dot on your map that was like, progress is here. So at least you knew it was like, oh, on this 2D map, I got to be going up and to the right, like somewhere in that general direction. Just having the place you're trying to find is this place, even if we're not showing you exactly how to get to it, can be enough to mitigate some of that frustration of I just don't know where the progress is.
Absolutely.
The Prime Trilogy does that already, kind of, actually.
Yeah.
So I expect Prime 4 to be the same.
Yeah, the only thing I think is difficult with how it's done in Prime is because it's a 3D
map.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It can be a little harder to orient yourself around. And that is, again, why I think, like, having that option of either the line or something like, in first-person view, point me towards like where that thing is, because there's sometimes a difference between I can see the dot on the map, but can I translate that into back in first person knowing where I'm looking?
Yeah, that's fair.
So some positive things that Prime 4 is doing accessibility wise that I think is great is flexibility of control schemes and making it really easy to swap between different control modes. Having played the demo that was at the recent Switch 2 experience, if you want to be playing with gyro controls and then switch to mouse controls and then switch back to gyro and then switch to just using your physical buttons and analog sticks on the controller, there's no having to pause and go into menus to do that. If you put the Joy-Con down on the table, now it's mouse mode. If you pick it up, now it's not mouse mode, and you can use it gyro.
Yes, I did want to ask you, how did you find the accessibility options or switching between controls during the Switch 2 experience? Also, side note, I'm jealous that you got to play Prime 4 and I still haven't.
I just want to hear all about your Switch 2 experience.
Tell us everything.
So, I can talk generally about it before getting into Prime 4 if you want. The short version of the overall thoughts, the Switch 2 feels so nice. Despite being bigger, it doesn't feel any heavier than the current Switch. The lack of an OLED screen really doesn't matter that much in practice. That new LCD screen is really nice. And I think the trade-off of being able to play at 120 FPS in handheld mode, totally worth it. That screen looks so nice. I don't understand the magnet Joy-Cons, having used them. A Nintendo rep told me to try pulling them off just by force without using the detach button. I could not do it. You press the little button, it pops off really easily as if it was never connected at all. I understand less about how magnets work now that I've used the Switch 2 than I ever did before. But yeah, in terms of like Prime 4's control stuff, if you're someone who struggles with gyro, where gyro is going to be a problem for you, you can turn sensitivity in the pause menu just all the way down to zero, so that like gyro just doesn't do anything. Similarly for mouse controls, they have sensitivity controls, so you can like really whack up how sensitive the mouse mode is. This is not useful for me, but the best compliment I can give mouse mode is, if you want to make the Joy-Con mouse so sensitive, it feels like you're one of those Call of Duty gamers who moves their mouse a millimeter and does a 180 degree turn and is facing behind them. You can turn your sensitivity that high.
You tried that for a little bit, didn't you?
Yeah, it's not for me being that sensitive, but it is nice to know that if you're someone who wants to play it like a really twitchy first person shooter, you can. My brain struggled to process mouse mode a little bit at first, because when you put a sideways Joy-Con down on the table and you're using it as a mouse, my thumb was still hovering kind of near the analog stick. And even though I'm using this as a mouse, my brain goes, there's an analog stick there. Use that to turn. Detaching your brain's association that analog stick means turn is a little tricky at first. Yeah. As is the fact that, you know, I'm someone that uses a mouse for work. I use a left and right click and a scroll wheel. I'm not one of those buttons on the side of my mouse that I use with my thumb people.
Yeah, me neither.
And playing this in mouse mode, you kind of have to use the face buttons with your thumb, and that takes a bit of getting used to. And this is why I was so appreciative that you can just pick it up and not be in mouse mode at any time. Because what I ended up doing a lot was like, oh, I'm going into morph ball mode, I'm scanning with my visor, I'm just doing regular platforming, I would pick the controller up, play it like any other Metroid Prime game. Oh, it's time for shooting, put it back down on the table, be using it as a mouse for shooting.
Call of Duty mode.
Yeah, and the fact that there isn't any kind of, like, there's no delay, there's no settings, it's just very instant to go between the two of them, does mean that you can go, I like this control mode for these actions, but I find it difficult for other actions. I'm just going to keep swapping back as and when is good for me. And I think that kind of flexibility is really rare to see in console gaming Nintendo of any kind, that you can just completely change your control scheme without having to set a setting to do it.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, other than that, there was very little in the settings menu, at least in the demo that was being shown off. You could invert your sticks and change the analog stick sensitivity. That was it for settings that were touchable in game itself.
Okay.
There's one kind of setting that I kind of want in Prime 4, and it's similar to how Dread does the map.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would get too cluttered if each and every room had those door symbols.
Mm.
But if you hovered over that room, maybe the symbols could show them. And if you just gained an ability, for example, you could see all of those symbols on your map.
Yeah, I think there's ways you could do it. Like, if, for example, you had like one symbol, that symbol was, you have the tools to go through this door, but you haven't gone through it yet, and you just highlighted, you had a toggle to go, just show me doors that I can go through that I haven't been through yet, like new places I have the tools to go to. That wouldn't be too cluttered, and that would give you a lot of that information. Or being able to toggle, like, specific icons, so rather than showing all icons and all doors, it's like, oh, I now have the missile, I'll just select the missile icon, and it'll show me all the doors that the missile works on, for example.
Yeah.
Like, there's definitely ways you could give some of that information in 3D.
They could also have their own screenshots of the game, like in Prince of Persia, but like they are the ones doing it, for example.
Another example I really like that I saw done this was paywalled behind having a PlayStation Plus subscription, but for on the PlayStation 5, the pack entitled Astro's Playroom, if you got stuck on a puzzle and you had PS Plus, you could pull up an official video in game that was like, oh, here's a little video of what the solution to this puzzle is. Like, the developers made walkthrough videos per puzzle that you could bring up if you were, like, truly stuck on a puzzle. And those as, again, something that you could contextually bring up. Like, I'm stuck trying to work out how to get through this puzzle, just bring up a little video for me. I think developer-created in-game walkthrough videos are a great idea.
They did that in Ocarina of Time 3D, I think.
Was that if you went to the Sheikah stones, I think?
If you went to the little...
Yeah.
Yeah, the little stones, you could, like, crawl into it, and it would tell you, like,
yeah,
what to do next.
Yeah, I think stuff like that is... Again, there's a lot of developers in the Metroidvania space that don't like the idea of that, because it's like, no, getting lost is the point of it. But, again, I maintain... If your game stops being good because a frustrated person was helped through a problem, if that stops your game being good, I don't think you've made a good game.
Yeah.
Yeah, or, you know, if you can have the option to do, like, I don't know, maybe a casual mode or a classic mode, and you can do the classic mode that doesn't involve that. If you want to play the casual mode, have all the extra hand-holding. Because at the end of the day, it's a game. Like, yes, it's still art. But it's a game. You're trying to have fun.
Exactly. But yeah, last thoughts, I guess, about, like, specifically Prime 4 accessibility. You mentioned at the start, like, you know, obviously ideas of reducing visual flashing and things for photosensitive players. I think that is going to be a more important issue with Prime 4 than perhaps any other Prime game. The demo for Prime 4 alone, and, like, I don't know how representative this is going to be of the whole game. I feel like this is an opening sequence that is a bit more cinematic than other sections are going to be. But, like, that opening 20 to 30 minute demo is so full of, there's other characters around you, there's explosions going off, there's things escape pods crashing through the ceiling and exploding. It constantly feels like there are things happening around you visually in your periphery. That's, like, just a lot to take in visually, even if not for photosensitivity reasons, just from being a bit overwhelming. And, like, that's... You know, there was definitely some of that in Prime 3, but it definitely feels like they've really ramped up the there is constantly visual stuff happening everywhere that could maybe be useful to be able to tone some of down just for... I'm just focusing on the stuff that is important gameplay-wise, visuals.
I have a semi-related story just related to that I just think is funny, and that's just... I was playing... I can't remember what I was playing. I think it was when the 3DS first came out, and I was playing that for a really long time, and ended up with, like, a really bad migraine afterwards because I'm prone to migraines. And my mom goes, "You're not having like seizures or anything." Like, "Mom, I have never had a seizure in my life. And I've been playing video games since I was three. I think if that was what was going on, I think that sort of thing would have happened already." I think it's just a migraine, Mama.
Oh, yeah. Migraines are not fun. I had one of those for the first time about a year ago. I was like, oh, I finally understand. This is not just a bad headache. This is terrible.
Yeah. It's another reason why it would be great if you could adjust some of the lighting on games, because that's one of the things that gives me migraines.
Yeah. Off the top of my head, I don't know if this comes up in... I can't remember if this came up at all in the Prime 4 demo. One great thing I've seen for accessibility in shooters recently is any time that, like, you have flashbangs that would turn the whole screen bright white to disorient the player, having options to turn that into... It turns the screen black to disorient the player. It has the same ultimate effect, but it doesn't put searing bright white in your face. That can be really good for, like, minimizing the risk of, you put bright lights in my face and migraines started happening.
I think that would be useful, even for me. I don't have visual issues like that, but I am someone that toggles dark mode on every sight possible.
Yeah, sometimes it's just nice to not have your eyes strained by things.
I think most people would appreciate that.
Yeah.
It does, especially when I'm as chronically online as I am.
I mean, aren't we all people talking about video games on the internet?
Everyone gives me so much crap for not using dark mode on everything. Everyone's like, you use light mode on this? I'm like, yeah, I know.
Is this a good place for us to talk a little bit about the mouse grip stuff?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'll jump over to this. So a few months ago, and this was before we had any confirmation of the Switch to officially having mouse mode, as someone that like is passionate about accessibility and was a bit obsessively following rumors around the Switch 2, I worked with someone earlier this year at the printbed.bluesky.social to create a mouse grip for the Joy-Con 2 that is freely available, that you can just find the 3D print files online. We based it off of leaked 3D printer files for the Switch 2, which I have had a chance to test this out. It does work with an actual Joy-Con 2, which is a relief. And all it is just a piece of plastic with a groove in it to slot the Joy-Con into. Because the Joy-Con 2 works surprisingly well as a mouse in terms of, like, left and right click and move around mouse functionality. It's really thin in the middle of your hand. And it is not comfortable for long periods of time to hold. Because you end up using, at least for me, my two smallest fingers on the back of the Joy-Con to sort of hold it on one side, thumb on the other, index and middle finger on top to click the mouse buttons. And it means sort of creating a bit of a pincer grip around it that is just quite narrow and a bit of a strain on the hand. Even if you're not someone with disabilities, I think it's not the most comfortable for a game like Metroid Prime that you are doing very fast, frantic mouse movements very frequently. I think it'd be a different situation for something like Civilization, where you are using it just as a mouse and pointer in a slow-paced game. And the idea of this was just to be a piece of plastic you could rest your palm on, to have a slightly more stable grip while using the Joy-Con in mouse mode. And as I say, thankfully, it does seem to work that you can actually slot a finished Joy-Con 2 into this. I will note, it's interesting, I've been following, because I was pretty certain that I would not be the only person trying to make something to make mouse mode more comfortable. And in the couple of days before recording this, I have seen on sites like Alibaba, mass-produced mouse grips for the Joy-Con 2 starting to pop up. But I want to talk about why they don't work, at least for Metroid Prime. Because they've clearly been designed by someone who hasn't played Metroid and doesn't know quite what is going to be important about that design. And I say this not to toot the horn of my own 3D printed thing. I have no reason to. I'm making no money off of that 3D printed design. I have no incentive to steer you away from other things. I say this mainly so people who haven't played Metroid Prime 4 know what to look for if they end up looking for, like, mass-produced Joy-Con mouse grips. Most of the ones I'm seeing pop up online from other companies, they don't leave the buttons exposed. There's a design I've seen going around that on the right Joy-Con, it covers the Y button, and on the left Joy-Con, it covers the whole D-pad. And this is important if you're not someone that's going to be, like me, picking up and putting down the Joy-Con intermittently while playing Metroid, and just keeping it in mouse mode while you play. The Y button is, I believe, for going in and out of morph ball mode while you're in mouse mode. It's either that or the scan visor. I apologize that I'm blanking on whether it was morph ball or scan visor. But either way, it not being able to press the face buttons while in mouse mode is a barrier for specifically Metroid. the grips that some people are producing that cover those buttons up, not going to be a problem for every game. Again, stuff like Civilization that's just using left and right click would be fine. But for Metroid Prime, whether it's the one that I've designed or other ones, you want to specifically look out for mouse grips that leave the ability to press all of the face buttons while still in mouse mode, ideally.
There's one question I have about the peripheral, though. And when you're slotting in the Joy-Con, is it, like, firm, or is it possible to easily take it out of the peripheral?
It seems pretty firm. Like, it's not going to accidentally fall out while in use. In as much as if I'm talking about my right hand, the right-hand side of my palm is resting on the plastic of the grip. My thumb is sort of on the left side of the Joy-Con, sort of near the analog stick. That alone is enough pressure to be like, oh, it's not going to go anywhere. It's being supported on both sides. But it's not so firmly that you're not going to have to wedge it out of this thing or anything. It's just that gravity downwards is putting it in the groove, and your thumb,
I see,
is on the other side to stop it, like, falling to the left. If that makes sense.
I imagine that makes sense, yeah. I imagine having to use my ring finger and the pinky to maybe make my hand go upwards while pushing the peripheral down. Like, let's say I'm not using the mouse mode for a little bit, and I want to seamlessly swap to gaming with both Joy-Cons.
You should just be able to take it out by index finger and thumb lifting it out. Should be no trouble. Just pick it up, put it back down in.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that is, at least from the brief testing I did, and I can only say so much about this. I had very little time to test this with an actual Joy-Con.
Yeah, that's fair.
A bit of being open about this. Most of the sections at the Switch 2 hands-on I went to, where I politely asked, I was like, is it all right if I try putting the Joy-Con into this piece of plastic I made for accessibility reasons? Most of them were like, no, Nintendo have told us we're not allowed to let you test anything not approved officially by Nintendo. I found one very nice Nintendo employee who I explained accessibility stuff to, and he was like, that's really exciting, go ahead, try it.
Oh, yay!
Very nice, yay. But I had to be quick because he wasn't really supposed to be letting me try the Joy-Con with my knockoff peripheral. so I had to be very quick. Yep, it's in, it's not falling out, it comes out easily. Cool, done, run away, thank you, sir, no one saw anything.
You have to run.
Yeah.
Ah, cool. No one saw that.
Just turn around for a second and the time for you to tie your shoe. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't see anything.
He was very polite, but it was very clear. This was a, yes, I'll let you try your thing, but I better not be caught breaking the rules for you.
Yeah.
That was sweet of him.
Yeah. It's side note. There was some odd accessibility stuff out of the Switch 2 hands-on event that might be interesting to talk about briefly. First, Donkey Kong Bonanza? That's a third-person platformer, not usually a genre that makes me motion sick. I got motion sick playing that game.
Oh, and that is good to know.
And it's apparently not just me. At some of the more recent American events that have been going on, they've started asking people before they play, are you prone to motion sickness? So they know there's a problem with that demo. I've been trying to work out exactly what it is that's going on. I think part of it is the sort of dramatic, the hit stop animation when you hit stuff really hard as Donkey Kong is causing some sort of stop start to the animation that might be part of it. But, like, it's really hard to tell what's doing it. But even as someone that, like, doesn't usually get motion sick at third-person games, that is causing some problems.
That is very good to know. I'm glad to know that because I do get motion sickness. It's weird. I could ride roller coasters all day long and be fine.
Agreed. But yeah, same.
There are some games that, like, will make me so freaking sick.
Yeah. And Donkey Kong Bonanza, not the kind of one that I would have thought would do it.
Oh man, that's so disappointing. I hope that improves.
Yeah,
I really do.
And like, yeah, that game's like another couple of months out, you know, from launch. It might be all right. But like, yeah, something was definitely a little funky at that demo. And like the last one from that hands-on that's an interesting accessibility thing is you know the game they showed off in the Switch 2 Direct, Drag and Drive, the wheelchair basketball game?
Yes. I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah. Nintendo people at the London hands-on, the Nintendo staff, were told not to refer to them as wheelchairs.
It's vehicles, right? That's so strange.
Yeah. Yeah, they were told, if someone calls them wheelchairs, they were told to be like, oh no, don't call them that. We call them vehicles.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And it's such a strange choice because it's very clearly wheelchairs. I don't know why they're scared of the word wheelchair, but apparently they're a little scared of it.
Do they think that it will upset people who use wheelchairs? Because I'm pretty sure everyone calls them that.
I don't know if it's that. I don't know if they're like, we don't want those kind of capital G gamers to get upset that it's a woke game. It's got disabled people in it. It's like, as if...
I feel like it's going to go one of two ways. You have the ones who are going to be like, oh no, it's disabled people. And then you're going to get the really weird ones who are going to be like, well, you're appropriating disabled culture for profit. And like, both sides are equally crazy.
Everyone I know who uses wheelchairs are like, that's really cool.
It's really cool.
A game with wheelchairs. Cool. I'm like,
they're seeing themselves.
Yeah. I don't think Nintendo needs to be scared of it, but like,
Nintendo's really funny about a lot of that sort of stuff.
They're very peculiar sometimes. I love them. I love their games. Their games are great. They're a bit peculiar about these things sometimes.
Yep.
But yeah, regarding that mouse grip peripheral, for anyone who's got Blue Sky, I'm sure that there'll be a link somewhere, or go to theprintbed.bluesky.social.
I'll put a link into the description of the episode to get it.
Yeah. It is, as I say, completely free. We're just trying to be helpful and make sure that it's available for people who need it. Sometimes you can get either free or cheap access to a 3D printer at libraries, which is available. Also, if you're someone who wants one of these and can't find access to a 3D printer, if you message me on Blue Sky at Laura K. Buzz, there are people that have offered to me they will 3D print these and post them for free to people just to help get these out. So if you can't find access to a 3D printer and that's going to be a financial barrier to accessing one of these, let me know. I have a list of people who want to help get these to people who might find themselves needing them.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That is amazing.
Yeah, there's apparently very nice people with 3D printers that just want to help make games more accessible, which is heartwarming.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really heartwarming. I was checking for options, and in my case, it would be a local library doing it, but people offering to help like that, that's really nice.
Yeah, it's one of the things I've really loved about being in the accessibility space, like, the last 5 years or so, is the frequency with which people are just like, oh, if there's something I can do to help, let me know. There's a lot of people out there who do want to go out of their way to help make games more accessible to more people. And I think I'm not surprised that that's the case, because at the end of the day, we all love video games. And surely if you love video games, you want more people to be able to enjoy the thing that you think is great.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people that, you know, that's enough to motivate them to be like, yeah, what can I do to help more disabled people play games?
Yes. Well, my brother has a 3D printer, so I'll just get him to print it for me.
Hurrah!
But that's me, so it's amazing that there are options out there for people who, let's say, don't have a brother with a 3D printer. They can still get this grip.
Yeah. But yeah, as we're getting a ways into this recording, did any of you have any other questions about Metroid Prime 4, either accessibility-wise or just generally, anything you want to ask me while I'm here, having played it?
Was it a magical experience?
Oh, it's so good. It's so good.
I'm so excited.
It weirdly reminded me of the... It feels different to the previous Metroid Prime games in the same way that the preview footage for Doom the Dark Ages has felt, in that there's, like, more NPCs around to have conversations with, more, like, it feels like there is more going on around you than just, it's just Samus alone against the world. And that sort of fleshing out of, there is a wider conflict happening around you, has, like, really energized the feeling of that game in a way that's really exciting.
I have two questions purely on world building, not accessibility. We've heard a little bit from pre-release footage that it sounds like they might have female Federation troopers. Is that true?
So I was only hearing audio through a TV in a very crowded convention center.
Okay.
But I do believe there were voices that sounded female to me. So my gut says yes.
Cool. Because there were only female fleet troopers in Prime 3, like the support staff. So I think that's awesome.
If you message me about this after the recording, I will rewatch through my 20 minutes of footage and see if I can, for a fact, confirm that.
Okay.
There's one in the cutscene.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I think Prime 4. Yeah, hurrah. I'm not imagining things.
Yeah. I also think that Samus might have new effort sounds, which means a new actress has been hired, or they used old sounds somewhere, which is of particular interest to me because a couple of years ago, I spent a year investigating to find Samus's actresses who'd never been credited before. So it's exciting that there might be a new one that I can add.
That's interesting.
Was that a couple of years ago? I thought it was like...
Yeah, I know.
Last year...
I know.
I mean, let's face it, the last 5 years have all blended into one big one.
We're in the weird wibbly wobbly time verse now. It's all wobbles.
It is wobbles.
All right, so in our last episode, we asked you guys what were your thoughts on the trailer for the Metroid Prime 4 Beyond, and let's see what you guys had to say. Gus185. Sorry if I'm saying your name wrong. I really do apologize. But here's what you had to say. I've never been so excited for a game before, so obviously I appreciated the fact that the trailers existed, but I can't help but feel that they're not really marketing it well. Most people who watched the trailer from the Direct 10 months ago were confused on whether it was a remaster or not until the title drop, because Prime Remastered set up expectations for 2 and 3, which most casual fans haven't played. Also, the second real trailer being an overview type with the narrator saying cheesy lines like "she can open doors" felt a little disrespectful to the series. Plus, they didn't even show the opening cutscene outside of the treehouse, even though it was very cool and would have made any sci-fi nerd buy it. Even so, the game looks so good, and I hope it sells zillions. Well, that was a whole lot to unpack.
Morph into a ball with the morph ball.
Another comment on the marketing, John Skiles 350 says, other than the fact that Nintendo clearly can't market Metroid the way they should, I actually think Prime 4 is shaping up to be a decent success. Definitely seems like they're taking aspects from every one of the other entries, specifically Prime 2. So you hear that, Nintendo? Like, everyone says you need to market Metroid better, because you do, because Metroid is great and more people should play it.
Yes, they're probably hoping that word of mouth and the fact that they announced this 8 years ago will help, but they need to ramp up the marketing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if they're not showing it now, it could be a sign that they're planning to push it to later in the year.
Part of me does wonder, is it further out than we think it is?
Could it be the holiday game?
Yeah, like if this is, say, December, and they, you know, start a ramp-up campaign in October.
Oh,
like,
goodness.
My guess is October, November is probably when it's coming out, but, like, if it's coming out December, I'm not surprised they're not starting the big push for it yet.
Yeah.
They tend to wait recently with a lot of their big games to, like, start pushing it just, like, a couple of months beforehand. I personally think it's going to be a September-October kind of game, just because it's I don't know. It has kind of a, I mean, it's, it'd be good for Halloween. Yeah. So like it sets the tone.
Dread was in October.
Exactly. Yeah. That's one of the other reasons why I'm thinking of it. It's like, well, Dread was October, yeah. So I could see this.
If we look at their marketing pipeline for something like Tears of the Kingdom, that one trailer where it's like, oh, let's show off all the new abilities with the arm and the fact you can like fuse weapons together and make vehicles. That was like just over a month before that game came out that they actually showed you here's what's new in it and why it's exciting. They really do seem to want to do their big, like, here's what's actually exciting about the game push, like, no more than a month or two before they're ready to release.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, Echoes of Wisdom, they just announced the game one day, and it's just, oh, we're getting a Zelda game where you're playing as Zelda, and then it was out within a couple of months. All right, so one more comment. This is from Mewtube HK. It feels like they're keeping their cards tightly close to their chest with what they're choosing to show off, but I personally think that's an okay approach because most media nowadays, from what I've seen, reveal too much ahead of time. It'd be a shame to have waited out the game for so long only to be heavily spoiled on something either by accident or through people's laser focus analysis.
Metroid Dread.
I mean, that's a good point.
It is.
Dread was exactly like that.
Not that this is a game, but the Snow White remake, they showed a clip from the final scene, basically, so the ending did change, but they showed a clip of the new ending, and, like, spoilers.
Yeah. I kind of agree with the... As someone who's already invested in this series... I don't want to know too much, just put a new Metroid in front of me and let me play it unspoiled. But I also recognize, like, Metroid is a series that has historically not sold amazingly. The best-selling entries have, like, recently have been, like, Dread, where it didn't have a number and it felt like its own thing you could jump into.
And we got a whole new generation of Metroid fans with that, and so they don't... We still need to get more Metroid fans and appeal to that new generation.
Yeah, and to get them over to the Prime series, which has a number and a subtitle. And, like, again, I think if this had come out, like, if this had been a launch day cross-gen title for Switch 2, I think that would have really helped for Metroid to be like, oh, everyone's excitedly looking for things to play on their new hardware. I guess I'll try a Metroid. It feels like such a missed opportunity. They weren't there for that.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of people are excited for the 4K opportunities and Prime 4. Perfect.
Right. I think that's going to be, as long as it can be one of the first, like, 4K 60 or, like, 120 FPS games on Switch 2, I hope that alone will get people trying it who might not otherwise care about Metroid and that might help it.
One can hope.
Yeah.
Yeah, they need to do something to appeal to all the new Metroid fans, because a lot of the new generation of Metroid fans have only played Metroid Prime. They haven't played 2 and 3 because there's not really access to it right now.
Mm-hmm. Give us 2 and 3, like, right now. Give them. You've probably got until December before Prime 4 comes out, I'm pessimistically saying. That's time for, like, give us Prime 2 in July, Prime 3 in September, Prime 4 in December. There you go. That's the year of Prime.
Yeah, I want something fun to play this summer. Give us, like, all the Prime.
Yeah, what if they make trilogy for the Switch 2 with mouse controls?
Oh, the whole trilogy playable with mouse controls would be really nice, actually.
Yeah, it would. All right, well, my question for you guys for next episode is, what kind of peripheral would you like to have for Metroid?
Oh, so many choices.
I know, I'm thinking of a whole bunch of stuff right now, right off the top of my head, so I'll have to keep those in mind.
I've got so many highly impractical things I would love to exist.
Right? All right, everybody. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you, of course, to Roy, Irene, and Laura. Thank you so much for coming on and telling us all about your work with the accessibility world.
Thank you very much for having me. This has been delightful.
Thank you so much. And we'll see you next mission.
See you next mission.
See you next mission.
See you next mission.
I'm joined today by Roy, Irene, and special guest Laura Kate Deal. Sorry, I said Deal instead of Dale. I'm going to try that from the top.
Yeah. And welcome to episode 33 of the Shine Sparkers podcast. Let me try that one last time. I can't talk today for some reason. All right.
I was very happy when LinkedIn introduced dark mode.
Yeah, now you can do dark business.
Wibbly wobbly timely wimey.
Exactly.
Darren's been introducing me to Doctor Who the last year, and yeah, I'm a Whovian now.
I don't know. I'm guessing this is supposed to... I don't know how to pronounce this person's name because there's a whole bunch of letters, but it's G-U-3-Z, so I'm guessing Gez or Gus185. A lot of the new generation of Metroid fans have only played...
The Shine Sparkers podcast is edited by Stefan Wells with music from Maserati. If you enjoyed what you heard, we hope you'll consider following us on our social media pages. We're on Twitter, Blue Sky, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. For the latest Metroid news, interviews, community features, and other exclusive content, visit our website at shinesparkers.net. See you next mission.